All right, good evening, everybody. All right, this is CS50, Quiz Zero Review. So first, a few details. The quiz is on Wednesday, October 13th, 1 p.m. See the handout for locations. It's cs50.net/quizzes-about-quiz-zero. This quiz will cover week 0 through 5, so that was things that was taught up through last week's lectures and in your sections this week. It's closed book. You cannot bring any textbooks into the thing, but you can bring an 8.5 by 11 two-sided sheet of paper. Just some strategies to making them. I made mine 8 font. It was in total 2,000 words. Fit as much as you can onto this. Even if you think you have nothing left to put on it, go and copy source code, and you can actually put it on your cheat sheet. The test is 75 minutes, and it's 15% of your final grade. Some resources for studying. You have old quizzes and solutions online at cs50.net/quizzes. Lecture slides, lecture videos, transcripts, source code, scribe notes, section videos, PSETs, and of course office hours, which we'll be having both Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday nights. All right, so to start off, we're just going to ask the audience for some topics that they'd like to cover tonight, and we're going to put those up on the board and then rank those in terms of the most important to the students. So does anybody have any particular topics that they would like to cover? Yes. Recursion. Yes, back there.
Pointers and arrays and the relationship between them.
Awesome. Any other topics?
Linked lists.
Linked lists, great. Right there. Structs. Any other topics? Any other topics, guys? All right. Yeah. What? All right, so now we're actually going to start the review with some of the slides that we prepared. So this is part 0 of the review. We're going to cover some of the basic stuff we learned in weeks 1 through 2. So the first thing we have are binary numbers. These are base 2 representation of numbers. The memory of your computer is contained in bits that are either 1 or 0. So if you look at the binary numbers right here, our chart up here goes from 2 to the 0 to 2 to the 7th. So 2 to the 0 would be 1, and that's if it's either 0 or 1, it's represented by 0 or 1. And then 2 to the 1, 2 to the 2, 2 to the 3, 2 to the 4, and so on. The maximum 8-digit binary value is 8 ones in a row, which is equal to 255, or 2 to the 8th minus 1. So let's do some practice with binary. What is 122 in binary? So if we look at that, we can see that the answer is actually 0111010. So 2 to the 0, in this case, since that's not actually applicable, it's 0. And then we have 2 to the 1, so that's 2. 2 to the 2, not again applicable. But then we have 2 to the 3, which is 8, so that gives us to 9, and so on. And now if we look at what is 00011001 in decimal, that comes out to 25. Are there any questions on that? All right, let's look at one other thing, which is binary addition. So in binary addition, if you have a 0 and a 1, that sums up to 1. If you have a 0 and 0, that sums up to 0. And if you have a 1 plus 0, that sums up to 1. If you have a 1 plus 1, that actually sums up to 10, but you carry the 1 over to the next column. So if you look at this right here, we have 0 plus 1, so that's going to be 1. But then we carry that 1, so that's 1 plus 1, which is, in this case, you carry the 1 over again, and 0 plus 1, so that'll factor down to 1. You can kind of see how the math works out right there. And we get to 10001101. Does that make sense? All right, awesome. Another way of representing decimal numbers is with hexadecimal. So these are base 16 with 16 distinct symbols, ranging from 0 to 9, and then we go from A to F. So each digit is a nibble, or 4 bits. So 1 bit and then 8 bits is a byte. So if you had something like 0001 in binary, that's equal to 0x1 in hexadecimal. The 0x is just a prefix we put on there, noting that it's a hexadecimal number. If we have 111, that becomes 0 cross F, because in that case, that is 15. 00011, there should be an extra 1 there, sorry. That's 0 cross 1F, and then 10101111 is 0 cross AF. Are there any questions on hexadecimal? Yes?
What does the 0 cross mean?
The zero cross is a prefix denoting that it's a hexadecimal number. All right, moving on towards ASCII. So the great thing about ASCII is that it's an encoding scheme for integers relating them to the characters, key inputs. So it goes from 0 to 127. And what we can actually do is we can do arithmetical operations using the ASCII values. So if you do something like char b equals a in single quotes plus 1, that'll actually set b, your variable b, to the ASCII character b. If you do something like int e equals character d plus 1, that'll actually return the integer value of the ASCII value of d plus 1, which is 101. Any questions on ASCII? Yes?
For the top one, could have just said char b equals single quotes capital B, right? That was just an example.
Exactly, yes. Yeah, that's just... sorry, the question was, if you just put char b equals single quotes capital B, that is equivalent to this. It's just showing how you can add integers and characters like that. All right. Moving on to GCC and compilers. So GCC, it stands for the new C compiler, or nowadays the new compiler collection. Right now in our PSS, we didn't really see any compiling commands because we've used the make commands, which actually basically are typedef and these are aliasing them. So if you look, we have GCC program name.c, which just produces a.out executable file, and then you can run that file by doing dot forward slash a.out. If you do something like GCC dash o program name .c, that produces an executable file with the name of your file, so you'd run something like dot forward slash program name. Any questions on GCC? So here are some common compiling errors and warnings. If you have undefined reference to function getString, that means that you forgot to link in the CS50 library when you compile. If you have something like implicit declaration of built-in function square root, that means you forgot to include math.h in your program. Something like control reaches end of non-void function is when one of your functions that is not have a void return type did not return a value. Are there any questions? All right, awesome. Variables. Variables allow us to store information about the state of a program so we can access or change that state at any given time. Declaring a variable is very simple. It's int var1 equals 5, so we've declared an integer with the value 5. We can also do now var1++ with increments the var1. Printf %d var1 will print at 6. All right, be very careful of this. Do not write this. This is very bad. You're setting 42. Oh, whoops. You're setting 42 equal to that, so just watch out and I don't know. Yeah, don't watch out for the yeah, be careful of those. All right. We have some types in C now. So we have an integer, which is 4 bytes. It goes from negative 2 to the 31 to 2 to the 31 minus 1. A float is 4 bytes with 7-digit precision. Excuse me. So, and then we have a double, and some of you may be wondering what's the difference between a double and a float. A double is 8 bytes and 15-digit precision. Char is 1 byte. It goes from negative 2 to the 7th to 2 to the 7th minus 1. A long is 4 bytes, which goes from negative 2 to the 31 to 2 to the 31 minus 1. And a long is 8 bytes, and it goes from negative 2 to the 63rd to 2 to the 63rd minus 1. The difference between signed and unsigned types, basically what that means is you're increasing the range. If you have something like a signed int, it means that it can have both negative and positive values. If you have an unsigned int, it means it can only have positive values, and thus you've doubled its range in the positive spectrum. Just a note, too, is that the sizes above are machine-dependent and are not C-dependent. These are the most common sizes, but they will vary. Sometimes you'll see an int that is 2 bytes, but not in this class. Typecasting. Typecasting is very useful if you want to go between types. So if you have something like int old num equals 42, and then you want to say float new num equals float old num, what that actually is doing is that's taking old num 42, and that's turning into a floating point value. The same if we do here, char c equals char old num. That's actually giving you the ASCII character related to 42. Are there any questions on typecasting? Yes? A long and an integer, actually, there is not much difference between them at all. Some compilers, there is really no difference. I believe that's correct. All right, conditionals. So we've all seen these before. These are Booleans. or predicates, a statement that returns true or false, which must first be fulfilled for the code to execute. So these are represented with if, else if, and else statements. Here's just a quick example. So if we say int num equals get int, if num is greater than 0, you print f, you entered a positive integer. Else if num is less than 0, prints f, you entered a negative number. Else print f, you entered 0. Another great way to do this is with something called the ternary operator, or the sexy statement. So it lets you condense an if and an else into a one-line statement. So if you do something like int num equals get int, and then string statement equals num is less than 0, question mark, string error, colon, string valid, semicolon, what's that saying is, so this is the condition right here that has to be fulfilled. If this is true, it sets the string statement equal to error. If it's false, it sets the string statement equal to valid. So basically, the syntax for a ternary operator is your variable name equals the condition, question mark, if true, then else then semicolon. You can also load these statements up with commas and have them do multiple things there, although that can get a bit messy. Any questions on this? All right. Now we're going to move on to loops. So we have for loops. For loops have three parameters or more. We have counters, your counter initializations, your conditions that those counters have to fulfill, and then the changing of the counters. You're incrementing and decrementing your counters. So we have this example right here where we actually have multiple counters, multiple conditions, and multiple changing of those counters. So we have for I equals 0, j equals 0, I is less than 3, ampersand, which means and, j is less than 10, I plus plus, j plus equals 2. So what happens is every time you're going through that loop, you've initialized I and j to 0 at the beginning, and then every time you're increasing I by 1 and you're increasing j by 2, and you're making sure that I is less than 3 and j is less than 10 at all times. So this will basically print out a list 3 rows long with the I and the j value, because I will, of course, stop when it equals 2. Are there any questions? Yes?
Is that the same as a nested for loop?
No, not really, because if you look, these are both incrementing at the same time. If you look at something like a nested for loop, the question was, is that the same as a nested for loop? It's actually not, because in a nested for loop, what happens is you go through one for loop, then the other for loop increments, then you go through that for loop again. Yes? You don't really have to. I just did it to show that you can have multiple conditions in this. And the question again was, why did we add the condition j is less than 10? Sorry about that. All right, so we have two other types of loops, while and do while loops. So the syntax for a while loop is while condition do this in those curly braces. The syntax for a do while loop is do whatever your code is and then while condition. So the difference between this is that this loop checks, then evaluates. This loop evaluates, then checks. So this loop will check before it ever runs, but that loop will always run first, no matter what. It'll run one time before it always checks. All right, moving on to arrays. So arrays are a very simple data structure for storing objects of the same type. Imagine them as lined up mailboxes or, slots, each with its own distinct number. Or shall we say index? So when we count with arrays, one of my boxes is off right there. When we count with arrays, we start with 0 and then go up from 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. So if we want to declare or initialize an array, what we would do is something like int my array, bracket, bracket, equals, we have a curly brace and then comma separated values 4, 5, 6, 7. You can also declare an array like int my array 4, which is an array of size 4 with 4 slots. And then say something like my array 2 equals 3, something like that. So in this case, we've taken our 4 slots and we filled them up with 4, 5, 6, and 7. All right, the very last thing is using loops with arrays. Loops can be used to iterate through arrays. So if you have something like int my array 4, which is declaring an array of size 4, you can go and populate that array with a for loop. So 4 int I equals 0, I is less than 4, I plus plus, my array I equals I. Are there any questions? Yes?
In your last example, do you have to put the number? In the first example, my array, do you have to put the length?
The size? Yeah. No, you do not.
Okay.
The question was, again, I'm sorry. If you go back to this example right here, into my array, bracket, bracket, do you have to put the size in those brackets? That's no. All right, so that's it for part 0 of our review. Next up is Josh.
Okay, so here's part one. We'll pick up now with libraries. So we've seen a bunch of different libraries in the course. Some of them include the standard library, which is the first library that we ever saw. It has printf in it, among a bunch of other functions. We've also used the math library. Some of you may be on pset 1. You do like round a floating point value to the nearest int. And then we also have the CS50 library that we gave you, which is really useful for getting different types of input from the user. So you might remember that in order to use a library, we typically need to include one or more header files, so something like pound include cs50.h, and then we go to compiler code. In order to actually link against the library, we need to include this dash l cs50 flag, or dash l, you know, whatever the name of the library is. So if it's math, then we want to use dash l m. If it's the standard library, then we don't include that at all, because GCC just kind of assumes that we want to link against that, even if we don't say so. Any questions just on libraries? Cool. So functions. So we've seen a bunch of functions, too, over time. The first one that we ever saw was this function called main. And main's really important because main is the first function that runs whenever you start running a program. So if you compile your code, you go run on the command line, this function is the very first thing that's going to run. So we see some stuff that's kind of familiar. We see int, main, and then we have void in here. We've seen you can do other stuff other than void, but we'll talk about that in a sec. Then we have these opening curly brace and this closing one at the end. In between is basically just the body of our function. So our main function here, we're going to do something, whatever. And at the very end, we have this convention where we return 0 from main if everything was OK. If we encounter some sort of error, some sort of problem, then we'll return some other value that's not 0 to indicate that there was a problem. So more generally, any function can have a return type. That's just the type of the thing that you're going to return. So again, main returns an integer by convention. Your own functions can return any other type that you can think of, or they can return nothing at all, so the return type in that case would just be void. Then you have the name of the function, and in between these parentheses, we specify any of the arguments that the function's going to take. So the first thing we have to say is the argument type, so if it's an int, if it's a char, if it's a char star, something like that, and then the name. The name is just like any other variable. It's how we're going to refer to whatever argument value we get from whoever calls us. And this just means we can include 0 or more arguments in our functions. And likewise, in between the curly braces, we have the body of our function. And then at the end, as long as it's not a void function, then we want to return some sort of value before we exit. So just in terms of how functions work, if you've ever been kind of confused about this, it maps kind of nicely to math. So if you think back to like high school math or something like that, we have this function here, f of x equals x squared plus 4x. And if you want to find out what like f of 2 is, it's really simple. You just plug in 2 in place of x and then do that on both sides. And you see that f of 2 is 2 squared plus 4 times 2, and that ends up being 12. So really similar concept here. Here, in this case, x is kind of like our input. It's like this function takes one parameter, some sort of number. We call it x. We're going to return basically this value x squared plus 4x. So the return value in this case of f of 2 would just be 12. And if we want to see the equivalent in C, then we've got this function. Again, we're going to say it returns an integer, and we say it takes an integer. It could be a float or a double if we wanted, but for this, we'll just say it's going to be an int. We call the function foo instead of f. It's just the decision I made. And then we return x times x, or x squared plus 4x. This is sort of the equivalent to this math function here. Any questions on this function stuff? Yeah. Okay, so why do we return the value instead of like printing using like printf or something like that? So returning stuff can be useful in a lot of cases. Sometimes we might want to have some bit of code that we want to execute multiple times. Like there's some functionality that we want in multiple parts of our program. And rather than like maybe writing out this equation every single time, if I just want to calculate it and then maybe use that number for some other purpose other than actually displaying it to the user, we want to return it so that our program can take that value and then do whatever it will with it. So maybe this value, it's not something we want to show the user, it's just something we want to use to calculate something else maybe, or you know, determine whatever we're going to do depending on what the function does. It may be that we just don't want to show it to the user. Is that well? Okay. How would I access the value? So I have an example of this. I think we'll look at an example that might kind of help you with that. Basically, you can take whatever this return type is, you can just assign it to a variable. But I'll show you that in a sec. Any other questions? Yeah.
Could you do printf and then %d, foo, 3?
Yeah, so the question is, if you had this function in your code, could you use something like printf %d as your format string, and then as the variable you want to print out, just type like foo3 or something like that? And the answer is yes, you could, because this is going to return an integer, and printf just wants an integer as that parameter if you give it %d. Any other questions? Okay. So now a little bit about command line arguments. So main, as we know, can take command line arguments, and the difference is instead of having void in here, we have this int argc char star argv bracket bracket. Argc, recall, is the number of command line arguments that your program gets. The first command line argument is always going to be the name of your program. So argc is always going to be at least one. Char star, you might remember, is sort of synonymous with this notion of a string. Then argv bracket brackets, this indicates that we have an array. So if char star is a string, this thing is like an array of strings. This is just an array that contains all of the command line arguments that you got in the form of strings. So remember that even if you get a numeric value, like for Caesar, for example, you had to take that numeric value that was actually a string and then convert it to like an int or some other numeric value that you could, you know, use for math and stuff like that. So to look at a quick example, if I run a program called program name and I give it cmd line args, so what's argc going to be? 4, right? If you said 3, you were close, but it's going to be 4 because it's 1, 2, 3, 4. It's the number of command line arguments. It's got nothing to do with indexing at 0 in terms of argc. But where 3 does come into play is when we try to access the different command line arguments. So argc is 4. That tells us there are 4 different values in argv. We start, as with any array, at 0. So it's 0, 1, 2, and 3. And these arguments are just going to be in order what you see up here. So program name is always going to be the first command line argument. Then, you know, cmd line args would be my next 3. Any questions on command line args? Yeah.
Why is it that you only need to check if something's null if there's only one argc is equal to 1?
Why do you need to check if something is null if argc is equal to 1 or
another? Argc is equal to 2.
Right.
And you have to check whether argc is equal to null or another.
I'm not sure that I understand the question. All right. Ask us later and maybe we can try to help. Okay, so now a little bit about scope. So we saw this function that creatively called swap that is supposed to swap 2 different integer values. As the comment kind of implies, it doesn't actually do that. And the reason for that is scope. So basically, whenever you pass something like an int to a function, we do this thing called passing by value. And what that means is if I'm the caller and I call this function called swap in my code, I'm not actually going to pass it, you know, the actual variables that I'm dealing with. I'm not passing it, you know, the memory addresses or anything like that of A and B. In this case, I'm just going to pass it a copy of the value A and a copy of the value B. So if I call swap on like 5 and 10 or variables that have the values 5 and 10, swap is just going to get those values. They're going to get copies of those values, but it's not going to have any way of referring to the actual variables where I've stored those things. So we're going to have this int A, this int B, and then this int temp, and these are all going to be local variables in the context of swap, and when this swap function goes away, we're not going to have access to any of those things. The solution we saw to this problem was to introduce this notion of passing by reference instead, where instead of giving swap the actual values that I want to swap, we're going to give it the memory addresses where those values are located in memory. So we do that by giving it pointers, so int star A, int star B. We'll talk a little more about pointers later on in the review session. But basically, the idea is swap now has access to these memory addresses, and by virtue of having access to the memory addresses, it now also can go see what these values are. And it can use these memory addresses to, you know, take the value at A, so maybe the value 5, put that in this local variable temp. It'll dereference this memory address again to put the value of B, so say 10 if that was our value, and it'll put the value 10 into this place where 5 was previously located, and then it can place the old value of A that we got over here and put that into the location of B. This will actually get that swap effect that we want. Questions on scope? Okay. Next little bit is about frames. This is going a little bit deeper into how memory works in C, and this will also hopefully show you how to deal with return values from functions. So we have 3 simple functions here. Sorry if it's a little small, but we have one function main down here. We have another function foo, and we have another function bar. Foo and bar both return integer values, and they take integers as their arguments. So if we start off in main, we have this line int x equals 5. Now, here I've just indicated, you know, 4 bytes in main. This whole thing is sort of the stack, so it's part of the computer's memory. And we start off with main on the bottom of the stack because, like I said before, main is the first function that runs when you start up your program. So I've just shown you 4 bytes here. They start off as question marks because we don't know what's there until we actually initialize it. So we say x equals 5, and that becomes 5. And then we move on to the next line. We say x equals foo of x. So foo, I said, is going to return an int, and x is of type int. So we can say something like x, which is of the right type to take an integer value. So it's an int. This returns an int, so that's good. And we can just say it equals foo of x. So whatever foo of x eventually returns is going to end up in the variable x right there. So we execute this. We call foo of x. We put foo is the next function we call. So main kind of like pauses its execution. And we move over to foo, which goes on the stack on top of main. Foo has this local variable n because it's declared as an argument that it takes. And foo, we said, returns bar of n times 2. Okay, so like I said before, we're going to copy the value 5 over to here so that foo can access the value 5 in its local variable n. And then this calls bar, so this is going to take its local variable I, which again is still going to be the same value as this. So we started out with 5 here in x, then we passed it to n. So bar of n is bar of 5, and then this becomes I in the context of bar. They're all different variables. They have different names because they're declared that way. And bar is just going to return I plus 1. So I plus 1 is obviously 6. So bar updates that, and then it returns over here to foo. So we've got bar of n, we've executed that part, and now we've got to multiply by 2, because that's what this whole line says. So we multiply it by 2. We now have n equals 12. And now we've got to return this whole value to main. And we do that so that 12 ends up here as we expect. Any questions on any of that? Cool. Okay, so one last bit about memory. So we've seen this picture before. This stack area was where we were just looking in the last few slides. Again, main would be on the bottom of our stack, followed by any functions that we call, any functions that call, and so on and so forth, kind of build up on top of the stack, just like a stack of trays or something like that. We also have this section up top of memory called text. This is where the zeros and ones that make up your program actually reside. So the instructions that go to the CPU all end up in the text segment. Initialized data, uninitialized data, both of these are used to store these things called global variables. These are variables you declare outside the scope of any function. So if you want to have a variable like g in the Sudoku problem set, this is where it would be living up in one of these two sections, depending on if it's initialized or uninitialized. They're sort of self-explanatory there. But global variables are just things you can access within any function because it has this thing called global scope. We have this thing called the heap, too, where you might remember malloc from recent weeks. We'll talk about that in a little more depth later. But the heap is where we get all of that memory, where malloc is actually going to go to allocate memory. And then this moves down just the same way that the stack moves up. And then we have this other thing called environment variables. Not such a big deal, but just know that they're there. Any questions on anything I've talked about? Cool. Okay. Next up is rows.
Hey guys, I'm Rose. I'm going to be doing the next section. So, hi, I'm Rose. I'm going to be talking about recursion, search, sort, and asymptotic notation. So let's dive right into recursion. So a recursive function is one that is one in which the program repeats itself. Well, okay, hold on. It's when a program repetitively calls on itself. I'll show you a recursive function in a bit, so just keep that in mind. And it performs a task by repeating smaller, similar tasks. Again, you'll see, an example in a bit. But let's talk about in real world terms what would like a recursive function sort of look like. So say you wanted to do 5 factorial. Well, you could just punch it into your calculator, or you can say it's 5 times 4 factorial. Now what's that? Well, that's 4 factorial is 4 times 3 factorial. And then you sort of go on until you hit 0 factorial. So once you hit here, you know what 0 factorial is, I hope, or I guess your calculator would. And then, it equals 1. So you would put it back up. And I've sort of drawn drawn your math here sort of suggestively of for recursion, which you'll see in a bit. But anyway, you would keep on putting the numbers back in. Oops. Well, anyway, you would put them all back in until you get back to your 5 factorial, which is 120. So that's sort of like a real-world example of what a recursive function would look like. Also, another note, you need a base case to know when to stop, because if you have a program that's calling itself forever, you want at some point for it to stop calling itself and like do something. Otherwise, it'll keep calling itself, and you'll probably like smash into the heap or something, and then bad things will happen. Okay, so let's talk about a more interesting example in C, as opposed to like real-world terms or math, which I'm not a big fan of, but between us. So why don't we print the characters of a string recursively? Because you know, you already know the iterative version, I hope. You know, for loop, iterate over the indexes and you print them. So the code will look something like this. I called it print chars. You can call it whatever you want, I guess. And here you can see I've marked out the base case. We're going to return, like we're going to stop calling itself when you hit that null terminator. So I think we'll talk about this later when we talk about strings. But the null terminator like ends like every string. And then you'll see the recursive part down there in light blue. It's the part where it calls itself. So from here, you can sort of see that you're going to send in to itself the character array, and you're going to increment the spot. So what does this actually like mean? Like, what the heck? OK, I can stand up here and tell you what it does, but I'm going to show you. So say in main, somewhere in main, I'm not going to show you the program in main, you have that line right there, and your str is FTW, and it ends with a null terminator. Cool. So we call print chars. So you can sort of see my little like sort of representation of the stack over there in the corner. You have main, which you know is the thing your computer starts, and then main calls print chars with str and position 0. So, well, it's sort of sorry that it's sort of small, but let's see what happens when we start execution of print chars. So, you know, in C, the program executes linearly. So first we check, okay, is our spot, is the thing at that index, the null terminator? No, no, because it's F. So we're going to go down and execute the else, which in our case we print. So we print the F. So I'm sort of like simulating what, you know, you would see on your screen as well as what the computer is doing. And then after that, you would call on itself. So we're going to send str back in with spot plus 1. So up there, you can see spot equals 0 right now. We're going to send in spot equals 1. So what happens then? Well, we build up our little call stack, and you have another instance of the program right there where spot equals 1. And we're just going to run through execution again. So are we at the null terminator? Well, no, we're at T. So we're going to execute else. And then what does that do? It prints, you know, the character. And then it calls itself with the next spot. So here, you know, we call it again, print chars, so it gets another frame on our little call stack. And, you know, you probably know the story from here. We print T, or rather, we print W, and then we call itself, builds up its little stack. And then here, interesting part, we check, you know, are we at the null terminator? Are we at the end of the string? Yes, we finally are. Awesome. So what are we going to do? We're going to return. So when you return from a function, I think as mentioned, its little frame kind of poofs, I guess, and the next one becomes the active frame. And then when you're calling, like when you recursively call the function, execution sort of stops when it calls on itself again. So that's sort of denoted here by the green arrow is still at that the recursive call. So when it unwinds and it goes back, you know, it continues executing and then it returns. And then this one becomes the active frame or the active instance of the program, I guess if you want to call it that. And that also returns, that returns. And then yay, we're done with print chars. And then main, whatever else main has, you know, it starts executing from that print chars line. Yay, cool, awesome, helpful maybe. Because I didn't like recursion when I took CS50, so I was like, I'm going to teach you all how to do this. Or what it looks like, I guess. Questions on recursion? Yeah?
Would you have to initialize spot to 0?
Spot to 0. Yeah, well, if you look at my my line up there where I first called print chars. Oh, sorry, the question was, would I have to initialize spot to 0? If you look at the line up there where it calls print chars for the first time, I send it 0. So it the first instance gets sent 0. Other questions? Okay. So here's an interesting fact, because I love recursion so much. So when you have a recursive program, where you put the lines matter. Where you call itself matters. Because like when you're building up your stack and you're unwinding, like execution pauses and then you'll see in a minute why it matters. So here we're going to switch the last two lines. So we bumped the recursive call up, and then we put the printf call down. So do you see why this will print the string backwards? Because it'll call itself and build up the stack without printing anything, and then when it unwinds and it goes back down, then it'll start printing. So to show you this visually, let's say we built up our stack, because you know I don't want to show that animation again. It's not very interesting. So here we're about to return, because we're at the null terminator. So yay, we return. And then execution goes back to the previous frame, where it was previously stopped at the recursive call. So what happens next? And spot is 2 in this instance, because we built it up like that. What happens next? Well, we're going to print. So at that moment in time, str with spot 2 is w, so we're going to print w. And then you know execution goes on, and then it returns, and then that frame is gone, so we go to the previous instance, I guess, of print chars. And then you know you can sort of see the story. Where execution was paused, it continues from there, and it prints out. And then it returns, and then, yay! Cool. So the ordering of your where you put your recursive call matters, because then you build up the frame, and then you know you or build up the stack, and then you unwind it, I guess. Questions on this recursion call stack? How it like looks, I guess. No. Yeah. Question.
Why do you have to put the /0 in single quotes?
Okay. The question was, why do you have to put the /0 in single quotes? Because I guess the short answer would be, it's treated as a character. So in characters, like when you did your Caesar Visionaire, you put characters in like single quotes. So the null terminator is considered just like a single character, so we have to put it in single quotes. So it's not like a string or anything. It's not like multiple characters. Does that answer your question? Cool. Other, yeah?
Is when like, you have the parameters for the function,
uh-huh.
You put char str brackets, mm-hmm. The same as char star str?
Yes. Well, the question was, is in the parameters, char str brackets, is that the same as char star str? Well, char str brackets is an array, versus if you had char star str, you would have a pointer. So if the pointer points to like an array, then it would be, you know, equivalent, I guess. But if it points somewhere else, then wait, let me think about that. I'll get back to you. Other questions? Oops. Okay, so a few helpful hints for recursion on the quiz. You'll typically see two types of questions. The first one, which, I don't know, I see more often than not. I don't know. I don't know what he's going to pick. But first question would be like, what does this do? And then we give you some sort of crazy-looking recursive function. How you should approach this is think about the call stack, you know, maybe draw it out if it helps you. Think about where execution like stops, you know, at the recursive call, and what happens when you build it up, and what happens when you like unwind it. And then the second type of question would be write a recursive function. This one, in my opinion, is a bit harder, but if you understand, you know, how it works, how you build up the call stack and how it returns, hopefully you'll be okay. So the questions you should be asking yourself is, what is repeating? And what, like, with that repetition, what is changing? So, like, in my example, the spot was changing, but it was still sort of printing out the same, it was sort of the same code to print the character out and such. And then you also got to remember your base case, otherwise you're going to, you know, smash into the heap, and then you're going to get a seg fault, and bad things will happen. Base case, very important, guys. Okay, questions on that, I guess, well. Well, if not, let's move on to searching. There's two types of searches. Let's talk about linear search first. So linear, it's what it sounds like. You just kind of walk through your array or your list, and you search. In our case, we're searching for the number 50, and yay, we found 50 after, like, I don't know, 5 steps or something like that. The other type of search is binary search. So how binary search looks visually is, you know, you have your list, you find the middle of it, you go there, you check to see if it's your number, and then if it's not, if your number is greater than or equal to the number there. So here we're searching for 50. 50 is greater than 42, so we're just going to get rid of the whole lower half of the list. And then you take what you have left, you find the middle of that. So now we're looking at 61, and we compare that to the value you're looking for. 50 is less than 61, so we get rid of the upper half of the list. And then we found 50. Yay! That took, what, 3 steps? That's cool. And then you do need to remember that your list needs to be pre-sorted for binary search to work, because if your numbers aren't sorted, you won't know that all the numbers that are smaller are on one side, and then all the bigger numbers are on the other side. So you have to sort it first to do binary search, but it's worth it because you saw how fast that was. So questions on this? Searching? Okay, so let's talk about sorting and the different types of sorting, one of which is selection sort. So here's sort of like the algorithm, pseudocode-ish, not really pseudocode, but pseudo-pseudocode maybe? I don't know. So what we're going to do is say we have this list, this array. We're going to look for the smallest number in the unsorted part. So here we haven't sorted anything, so all of them are in the unsorted part. We're going to keep track of which one's the smallest number. So that's what the red exclamation point denotes. So here, yay, 3 is the smallest. And then 3 is indeed the smallest. We switch it with the first. And then in the red is our sorted part. So we're not going to check that again because we already know that's the smallest. We put it there. So we go through again and we look for the next smallest number, which is, yay, 17. So let's switch that with 42, the beginning of the unsorted list. And then, you continue on doing that until, your array is sorted or your list is sorted. Awesome. Cool. Questions? No questions? Blank stares? Okay. So let's talk about bubble sort, my favorite kind of sort, because, I don't know, I like bubbles, even though you don't have bubbles in bubble sort, really. But anyway, here's sort of the steps you would go through to do bubble sort. You would go down your list, and then you would check two numbers that are adjacent to each other, and if they're out of order, you would swap them. And then when you reach the end of the list, to optimize, you would check and see if you made any swaps. If you didn't, then you would, know that your list was awesome. It's all sorted. And if you did make swaps, you'd have to go back and, do it again. So how this looks visually, say we have the same array or list or whatever. So our first iteration, 42 and 3, gotta swap them. 42 and 50, nah, they're fine, let's not swap them. 15, 17, swap. Second iteration, 42 and 17, gotta swap them. Cool, those are cool. And then I didn't really have room to show it here, but then you would want to go through once more, checking to see if there were any swaps made. And since it's already sorted, there won't be any swaps made, and then you can just return there instead of like doing it n times or something like that. Questions on bubble sort? Is it your favorite kind of sort too? Yes, score, I win. Anyway, so let's talk about merge sort. Merge sort is pretty cool too. I mean, I would like it, but I don't know. So merge sort is recursive. So here's sort of something that looks more like pseudocode. Sorry, the color is kind of not too bright. But so let's say that's what our function looks like, msort. You send in a list of n, and then it does all that stuff right there. So say we sent it in that list. So we send it in. First thing it's going to do is n less than 2. Nope, so it's not going to return. So it's going to check out the left half. And then it's going to send it back into itself, that left half. So there's the left half, and we're sending it back into itself. It's checking, is this left half less than 2? Well, obviously it's not, so we're going to take the left half of that, and then we're going to check again, because we're sending it in like recursively, so it checks every time you, yeah. And then we're going to do the left half of that, get 42. Is it less than 2? Yay, it is! Let's return. So execution resumes. Like, I didn't draw the call stack out for you guys here, but if you could like sort of imagine it, execution resumes where it left off, which was at msort left half. So now it's going to do msort right half. So it looks at 3, which is the right half of that array right there, and sends it into itself. Well, it was supposed to check, and then it merges. So it checks, it sees that 42 is greater than 3. And then it sees that 3 is greater, so it puts it in first, and then 42 comes in. And then now we're unwinding the stack, the call stack, if you can just imagine that. And we're going to sort the right half of that array up there. And 50, you know, it's less than 2, so we're going to return, and then we're going to merge 50 with our other array. So we can compare 3 and 50, 3 is smaller, let's put it in, advance our little like cursor on that one array, 42 versus 50, 42 is smaller, stick it in, and then stick in 50. Cool. So we're done with that array. So now, unwinding with our recursion, we go all the way to the top array, and we're going to sort the right half. Is that less than 2? No, so we're not going to return. So we're going to sort the left half because we sent that array back in. So it's going to sort the left half. That's less than 2, so yay. And then we're going to sort the right half. And then we're going to merge those two, 17 versus 61. Cool. And then now we're at, now we've like unwound like all the way down in our call stack, if you can imagine it again. So we're going to merge those two arrays there, the 3, 42, 50, and 17, and 61. So how this happens is, in more detail, you first look at each index of the two parts you have. In our case, 3 and 17. Which one's smaller? 3. So we're going to stick it in, and then we're going to increase that index. So now we're looking at 17 and 42. 17 is smaller, and then we increase that index for that array or list, I guess. And then we check 42, 61, 42, and then 50 versus 61. 50 goes in, and then 61 goes in. So we have our sorted array using merge sort. Questions about this one? Yeah?
When you do it, like in real code, would you have to create an extra array
even? The question was, okay, sorry. The question was, when you're programming this in C, I guess, in reality, would you need to create another array to put the numbers in? I would say yes, because otherwise you don't really have like the space. Or it might be easiest to, you know, have another array so you know there's space there, and then you can rearrange them that way. Okay. Yeah?
But you can't return an array like as a function, so how do you return? Do you have to copy it over back to the array finish?
Well, you can return, the question was you can't, I guess you can't return an array, question mark. And then how would you do it if you can't return an array? Well, you could return, like, because you know, I guess we'll go into this later, but the array name is sort of like a pointer to the first element of the array, so you can return that. And then you can do something with that, I guess. Is that what you were asking? Or if you want, you can come ask us afterwards. Well, you can return. The question was, you can return an array then, and we'll talk about this later. Sorry, that's coming up. But yeah, short answer, yeah. Cool. Other questions? Yeah.
So if we're trying to do this in C,
yeah.
Is there a function?
Not to my knowledge. You'd probably have to like write a different function and then call it in place of that merge sorted. Not to my knowledge in CS50, but I mean, you can create for fun. I would, you know, that's cool. Or maybe in higher level class. Fine, I like programming in C for fun. Sure? Well, I'm not sure.
She was in the hacker edition.
Oh, okay, I see. Well, since we're running a bit short on time, I'd like to, like, not answer questions right now and take them at the end. Sorry. Just like two more slides, or one slide, I guess. So we need to talk about this thing called asymptotic notation. It tells you the efficiency of an algorithm. So we've talked about this big O of n, which is the upper bound, you know, worst case, you know, upper bound of the time. There's omega, lower bound, and then you have this theta, which is what you have when your upper bound equals your lower bound, and n is the size of the input. So I would suggest on your cheat sheet putting some sort of table like that, unless you want to like memorize this stuff. But yeah, you can figure it out by yourself. Like say if we asked you bubble sort, what's the running time of that? You can like run through the algorithm and sort of figure out for yourself what big O is or omega is. But yeah, I would just suggest that you put it on your cheat sheet. Question. Well, maybe, can I take a question at the end? Because, yeah. Cool.
Hi, everyone. I'm Tian. I'm going to be doing part 3, or rather the fourth part today.
We're going to be talking about everything else that you guys need to know for quiz zero. I don't have as many animations, but here's the basic things that you need to know about pointers. So there's two things about pointer notation. The first is the ampersand, and the second is the star. So when you have ampersand and a variable, what you get is you get the address of the variable. Whereas if you have a star and you have a pointer, you dereference the pointer, and you return the value referenced by the pointer. So for my case, my name is Tian, and I live in Elliott House. So if you do ampersand me, you get the reference Elliott House. Whereas if you dereference Elliott House, you'll get me. So when you do pointer arithmetic, that's the way that you can move around pointers, which is the equivalent of the address of whatever variable you have in memory. And that way you can access things around your pointer. We'll be talking about this a lot more after problem set 5, after the quiz. But incidentally, for your information, array of I is the same thing as saying dereferencing the address plus I. And we'll talk about this more, but basics of pointers. Goodness. So malloc and heaps. Malloc is basically a way for us to dynamically allocate memory. So previously, when we had functions, we've created new variables in the function by saying int a semicolon. But here, we can dynamically allocate memory. And instead of putting it on the stack, which is local, we can put it on the heap, which through a previous animation, you can see is top down. This memory will exist up until you erase the memory, up until you free it. And you can reference it between functions. You can create memory in a function and then reference it back in main. You can create memory in one function and then reference it in another function. The one thing that you really need to know about malloc is you should always use it in conjunction with free. And essentially what malloc does is malloc returns a pointer. So in our example here, we can see that you can see type star array equals malloc size, and that's generally how you call malloc. Does anyone have any questions about malloc pointers? Free? It's pretty straightforward. So on to arrays and strings. You can see that an array is, the name of the array is just the pointer to the first value of the array. And in reference to the question posed to Rose earlier, can you return an array? You can't exactly return an array from a function per se, but you can return a pointer from a function. And from that pointer, you can see that the pointer would be the address of the array, and you can access things in the array like that. So if you created an array in a function with malloc, then you can return the pointer to the start of the array, and you can use that array in another function. You can use that array in main. You can use that array anywhere else in your program. And you can see that strings are just arrays of characters that end with a null byte, and the name of the string is just a reference to the first character of the string. Any questions? So going along the eclectic theme of my section, structs and typedef. So structs are custom objects of aggregated data types. So you can have a structure that includes many things. Typically, the examples that we see in class is a struct of the student. You have the ID, you have their name, you have all the information you want to know about that, about the person. The format of a struct is you write the word struct, you write the name of whatever you want to call this grouping, this object, and then you put all the stuff that you want inside, all the declarations. And when referencing data in a struct, you can do it in two ways. You can say struct.field, and that will give you the field inside the struct. Or you can do the pointers of the struct to the field. There's a typo there. So for me, if you want my name, you do tn.name. But since you know my address, you can say who lives at Elliott name. That'll give you the same thing. In terms of type def, it's the custom naming of data types and objects. The syntax is type def, whatever you want, and then the name. So you can do type def integer ID if you want to just call integers IDs for the rest of the program. Typically, what we see is we use type defs and structs together in this class, and you can do type def struct int ID character name and student. And essentially, what this declaration is doing is it's saying we want a structure with an integer and a string in it, and we want to call it student. And this way, in the future, you can just say, I want to create a new student, and the ID and the name will come with it. Does anyone have any questions about structs and typedefs? All right.
In regards to linked lists versus arrays, linked lists and arrays are similar in several ways. You can organize different collections of information. They're both traversable, and they're both organized together. But the difference between a linked list and array is that while arrays are fixed length and fixed order, they're giant contiguous blocks of memory. Linked lists are much more fluid and much more dynamic. You can basically put a node anywhere in your memory, and you can reference it because they're linked together. It's variable length, it's variable order, and they're non-contiguous. Also, with arrays, we saw before that they're indexable. So you can do array 1, or array 0, or array n, whereas linked lists, you have to go through the list. So when would you use a linked list versus array? The pros of a linked list is that linked lists allow you to arbitrarily insert and delete items, versus arrays where you need to reallocate or transfer the array whenever you want to delete something. So say you have an array of 5 items and you want to delete the second thing, then what you essentially have to do is you have to take out the second thing and then copy the first, third, fourth, and fifth item into a new array. Whereas in a linked list, you can just delete that node and stick everything else together. The other pros of linked lists is that they're easy to reorder, whereas in arrays you have to copy and swap, and it's just a huge mess, as you saw with the sorts that we had to implement earlier, O of n squared time. And there's no need for contiguous blocks of memory. So if you have something with tens of thousands of items, you would need an thing of tens of thousands of bytes altogether, versus a linked list, you can just find that memory wherever, squeeze it out. The cons with linked lists is because you can't index them, it requires linear time access. So if you want to find the nth item of a linked list, you have to go through the first one, and then follow the address to the second one, follow the address to the third one, follow the address to the fourth one until you get to the nth one, which is linear, whereas in array, it's constant. You can just go array of n, and that'll get you to the place. And the other con is the overhead for pointer data. So you need the information to get from one node to the other. So you need the pointer to the next one or the pointer to the previous one, whereas arrays are just contiguous. The con with linked lists is if you have something that's really small, then if it's only 4 bytes, why allocate another 4 bytes for the pointer? So the way that linked lists are constructed, usually we use the typedef struct node call. So you have a data and you have a pointer associated, a piece of data and a pointer associated with it, and another piece of data, another pointer associated, so on, so on. So you have a structure with a pointer to the next node and all the data that you want in it. So if you had a student node, for example, you would have typedef struct node next, and then you would have something like int ID, string name, int phone number, and then at the end you would call a student. And you can link them together and put them together in a massive list. Underneath, we can see that doubly linked lists are ones that point to the previous one as well as the next one. But for the purpose of this quiz, I don't believe you have to know that. Don't quote me on that. Does anyone have questions on linked lists? It's pretty straightforward. And then stacks and queues. The stack here is different from the stack that we talked about earlier. The stack that we talked about earlier were different ways that memory is sort of formed on your machine. Here it's sort of a data organization method. A stack, what you need to know about it is it's last in, first out. Essentially the way to visualize it, it's like a stack of paper. You put things on the stack, you take things off the stack, and it's a little bit of like a pile. My roommate came up with this analogy, but it's a little like a box of saltines. You can only grab the one that's on the surface. And with queues, it's the exact opposite. So it's first in, first out. So it's probably the most intuitive thing we'll talk about in the CS50. And it's just like a line. So you wait in line. If you're in line first, you get out of the line first. If you're putting a print job in first, you get the print job out first. And then the last slide of today, file I/O. So far in class, we've used 4 main file-related calls, fopen, fclose, which opens and closes files, fgetc, which gets a character from a file, and fprintf, which prints the file in stated format. Anyone have any questions? All right, I think we're all set.